Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm continuing on with the video with the Switch Pastor, where he gives us three reasons to believe that Christianity is true. Last time, we covered reason number one, which essentially boiled down to, if the universe began in a way that no cosmologist thinks that it actually did, then it had to have had a cause. Given that in this talk he is going to be presenting three reasons to believe that Christianity is true, and that usually in lists like this people start with the point that they think is the strongest, I don't have high hopes for the rest of the video, so let's see what else he has.
Argument number two is this: order from chaos.
Well, this should be interesting, because you believe that God created the universe out of nothing, not chaos. Although, when looking at the intricacies of the Hebrew words used in the opening verses of Genesis, an argument can certainly be made that God didn't do his creating out of nothing. He created out of a formless waste, where darkness was over the seas and only an awesome wind was sweeping over the water. That's actually exactly how Dr. E.A. Spicer translated those verses for the Anchor Bible translation. And with this translation, you can actually see how the Hebrew Bible continued the regional tradition of having your god defeat the previous gods in battle. In the Enuma Elish, which was the Babylonian creation myth, Tiamat is the goddess of chaos and the sea, from whom other gods are born, and through whom creation takes place. But when Enki, one of the younger gods, kills her mate, Apsu, she swears vengeance on the younger gods. Eventually, a champion of these gods, Marduk, arises and defeats her and creates the world out of her remains. Later, when the Assyrians from the north conquered the Babylonians, we find that versions of this story begin appearing in Assyrian texts with very little changed except that Marduk is rebranded as Asher, who was the Assyrian creation deity. So, when we look at the Anchor Bible translation of Genesis chapter 1, we can see what seems to me to be a rather obvious paring down of that same story, but with Yahweh taking the place of Marduk. And when we look at the Leviathan story as retold in Psalm 74, you can definitely see this cosmic battle against the chaotic sea god motif making an appearance, complete with a description of the creation of the world being the result of this battle. You divide the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the water. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You split open the springs and brooks. You dried up ever-flowing streams. Yours is the day, yours also the night. You have established the heavenly lights and the sun. You have fixed all the boundaries of the earth. You have made summer and winter. It very closely mirrors the language of the creation account in Genesis 1, but it frames it as a battle against Leviathan, in which Yahweh establishes his superiority as the supreme god. And if the Anchor Bible translation is correct, drawing that parallel was pretty obviously the intention of the author of Genesis 1. Now, why have I even brought this up, when that clearly isn't going to be where this guy is going with the order from chaos argument? Easy. Because I wanted to. I think it's fascinating, and this is exactly the kind of thing that I mean when I say that the people who insist on taking these stories literally at face value are missing out on the beauty of the text. They cheapen it to, it must mean exactly what it says literally, and when you reduce the Bible to just the words on the page, it becomes pretty clear that it's not a very well-written book by modern standards. But when you look at the cultural and historical context surrounding the text, it becomes a fascinating window into the culture, beliefs, and practices of the people who wrote it. Also, I'll leave a card to an interview I did with Dr. Joshua Bowen that touches on this topic. It is an excellent interview, if I do say so myself, though the reason for that is mostly because of who I was interviewing rather than me, but it's definitely worth the watch, so go ahead and give that a click. This video will still be here when you come back.
Order from chaos. Back in Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was formless and empty. That means that there was chaos, right? There was no order. That darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters.
Okay, but in your view, didn't God create the earth from nothing? Why would he start it off as chaotic? And if we're going back to cosmology here, it is worth noting that the universe today has significantly more entropy than it did at or shortly after the Big Bang. That's mostly due to black holes. If we take them into the equation, it's actually been pretty much stable. But apologists often equate entropy with chaos, even though that's not a great comparison. But if we stick with that, then the universe was more ordered at its beginning point than it is now. So it turns out that the universe is not an example of order from chaos, but just a typical example of chaos developing over time as order deteriorates. Also worth mentioning is that while the universe today contains significantly more entropy than it did just after the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe was not actually a low entropy state. It's only low relative to today's universe. So, once again, cosmology does not agree with the modern apologists' interpretation of the Bible, despite them bending over backward to make it seem like it does. Now, I'm skipping the next 2 minutes or so as he just tells the Goldilocks and the Three Bears story as though nobody has ever heard it before, and he doesn't even get it right.
Second bet also didn't work. Can't remember the reasons. It's been a long time since I read Goldilocks, but...
But when we come back, he will undoubtedly find a way to tie this into cosmology. I hope.
So what does that have to do with the existence of God? Great question. I'm so glad you asked. So this second argument, order from chaos, has been called by some the Goldilocks argument.
And I would argue that that's a bad name for it. Because the whole point of that name is that everything about the Earth is just right for life. But the thing is, it's not. Sure, we manage, but it's likely that super-Earths, that is, planets that are significantly larger than Earth, but significantly smaller than the ice giants in our solar system, are actually much better suited for life than our Earth is. They can usually be found orbiting around cool dwarf stars, stars that are more stable than our sun and which have a much longer life expectancy, giving life more time to get going and with fewer solar events that have the potential to wipe life out. They are more likely to have oceans that are shallow enough for the light to stimulate life all the way down to the seafloor. They tend to have thicker atmospheres, which acts as a nice little blanket to keep the developing life snug and warm. They are also more likely to be geologically active, which not only increases the likelihood of life developing in the first place, but also increases the chances that this planet would have a strong magnetic field, stronger than the Earth's, which protects the inhabitants of this planet from cosmic radiation. And this geologic activity is unlikely to reach levels that are similar to levels that we've seen on the Earth, where a sudden flurry of volcanic activity can cause a mass extinction event. So, as it happens, the Earth is not just right for life. It is merely a point within what turns out to be a fairly wide spectrum of conditions that can allow for life, and it's not a particularly desirable point at that. To put it in context of the Goldilocks analogy, Earth would be like the mother bear's porridge, which was too cold. If Goldilocks wasn't so picky, she could have eaten it, and it would have given her the same level of nourishment as the just right porridge, but it would have been a lot harder to choke down.
It's the idea that the universe appears to be designed to be just right for the existence of life.
It really doesn't, though. Like, if you are randomly transported to any spot in the universe, you've got a significantly greater than 99.9% chance of instantly dying. If you are randomly transported to any spot on the surface of the Earth, you've got about a 71% chance of ending up floating in the ocean somewhere and will end up dying. Of the remaining 29% of the Earth that is land, 33% is desert, which includes both hot and cold deserts, so Antarctica is included there. Most of the desert regions are completely uninhabited and for the most part uninhabitable, at least by humans, and so you will most likely end up dying of something like exposure or dehydration. So of the 510 million square kilometers of the surface of the Earth, that leaves us with 97.6 million where you have a somewhat decent chance of maybe surviving. But even then, you still have a not insignificant chance of winding up somewhere like, say, the middle of a jungle or on the top of a mountain or something. So most of the Earth is hostile to humans, the beings that God supposedly designed the universe to host, and a significantly larger percentage of the universe as a whole is even more hostile to humans, and it turns out that our planet isn't even the best kind of planet that we could live on. The fine-tuning argument looks less and less likely the closer you look at it. And also, the fine-tuning argument is, once again, not an argument that gets you to the Christian God. At best, it gets you to deism. This video is supposed to be giving us reasons to believe that Christianity is true, not just that there might be a God of some kind if you're willing to ignore the massive flaws in the arguments that point there.
so much so that it seems very, 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 very unlikely to be the product of random chance.
Who said anything about random chance? The Earth is the way it is because the events that led up to its existence behaved in accordance with the laws of physics. There's nothing random about it. Sure, we could have a discussion about why the laws of physics are what they are, but at the end of the day, the answer to that question is we don't know. If you're comfortable with the foundation of your belief in God lying just in us not knowing the answer to a very difficult question, that's fine for you, I guess, but I'm going to need something more concrete than just we don't know X, therefore God.
Now, one of the common misconceptions with this argument for the existence of God is that it's all about life specifically on Earth, and that's not actually the case.
Oh, are we going to finally get an apologist that's willing to address the fact that the Earth doesn't really seem to be all that special when it comes to hosting life? That'd be nice.
This argument doesn't just talk about human life on Earth, but any life in the universe at all.
Which now leaves us with the question, if sapient life developed outside of our solar system, did they also experience the fall? And did an alien Jesus go down to their planet in order to be tortured and executed by alien Romans in order to redeem the sins of all alien kind?
So I got this quote, feel really bad because I can't remember where I got it from, so I'm not giving credit, but I'm sure you can find it somewhere. It might've been from Hugh Ross's book, but I'm gonna read it anyway. So
is this guy not aware that you can prepare for giving talks? Like, first he forgets the problem that Goldilocks had with the beds, and now he can't remember who originally said a quote that he also says is easily Googleable. Buddy, if you want me to take you seriously, you gotta at least do the bare minimum of prep work.
This author wrote that we are told by today's astrophysicists that there were close to 150 variables that would need to be lined up perfectly in order for our universe to have come into existence.
Okay, I'm skipping the rest of that quote. It's nothing we haven't heard a million times before. It is, once again, a question to which we do not know the answer. Why are the universal constants what they are? Well, it's possible that universe creation is iterative in nature. That is, it keeps happening, and each time, the values are slightly different, and so it wasn't successful until such a time as the values are such that it will allow it to be successful. And we have no way of knowing how many iterations there were before our universe is what happened. It could also be that it's just not possible for the constants to not be what they are. It could be that there is only one fundamental constant that determines the values of all the other constants, and so with only one value to tweak, it becomes much more likely that random tweaking will result in our universe. It's possible that there are constraints on what these constants even could be, making values that allow for life more likely than not. It could be that cosmic inflation is a thing, where the cosmos outside of our universe is constantly expanding, and as it expands, the values of these constants change along with the expansion, and anywhere where it turns out that a universe would be possible, boom, a universe big bangs into existence, meaning that we are just one of potentially many universes with constants that allow for life. The fact that we do not know which, if any, of these are the correct answer does not point to a god. Also, the constants aren't all that fine-tuned. Turns out, when you look at what would happen when you change them, there are several potential values for these constants that will still allow for the development of life.
Like I said, these odds are so small and so unlikely that there are many atheist scientists who have described the appearance of the fine-tuning of the universe as one of the most compelling and powerful arguments for the existence of God.
Which really serves to point out just how uncompelling and weak the arguments for the existence of a God really are. If the best you have is, we don't know X, therefore it must be God, then you don't have much. Also, still waiting for him to address alien Jesus. But I guess that was probably just a throwaway line, and from here on out, he's not actually going to mention the fact that the Earth isn't special when it comes to being habitable.
And so the question becomes, what's the best explanation for the appearance of design that is present in our universe?
Well, the real answer is that I don't actually see the appearance of design in our universe, but granting that hypothetically, if we just agree that the universe looks designed, the real answer is that we don't have an answer yet. But if you insist on bringing supernatural causation into it, and insist that the supernatural entity be a personal one rather than a deistic one, then I think that polytheistic explanations work better than monotheism. That at least explains why the world doesn't actually seem to be all that well designed specifically for humans. Different gods would have been fighting over their priorities when they were doing their creating. The world we have is a compromise. I mean, technically, that's also the Christian explanation, with the lesser god Satan screwing up the creation of the supreme god, but generally, they don't like it when you point out that Satan and the angels and demons are definitionally gods as well, making Christianity a polytheistic religion with one supreme god and dozens, if not hundreds, of lesser gods. And that's even counting the three supreme gods as one, even though that doesn't make any logical sense.
Now, I would tell you all day long, the best explanation is what we find right there in the Bible.
Well, contrary to popular belief, the Bible actually contains zero information about any of the constants of the universe. You'd think that the all-knowing, all-powerful God who did the creating could have put some of that information in there, in a way that would be plain as day. While that wouldn't prove that the Bible actually is the Word of God, it would certainly go a long way toward eliminating the objections that non-Christians have to the claim that it is. I mean, in all of history, I can think of a grand total of one example where someone made a scientific discovery that was the result of them looking in the Bible for answers. And that one's a pretty weak one at that. It was when Matthew Fontaine Maury decided to look for the paths of the seas after reading Psalm 8:8. So we have a verse that might have been talking about the currents in the sea, something that we would expect ancient sailors to have been at least aware of, and the mere mention of such a well-known phenomenon is what ultimately led to one person deciding to map out these currents. Also, for what it's worth, he was yet another example of a good, upstanding, devout Christian man who believed very strongly in the institution of slavery and wanted to expand American trade routes to the Amazon basin using Americans and their slaves. There was work to be done by Africans with the American axe in hand. Not really relevant overall, but it's interesting to me that the one single instance of the Bible being used to make a scientific discovery was tainted by such a man. You'd think God could have inspired someone with a better moral code to make discoveries using his book. Anyway, back on topic, every other scientific discovery that is supposedly confirmed by the Bible has always come about through secular methodology, followed by apologists applying post hoc interpretations onto the text in order to make it fit the new discovery.
Why do I believe that Christianity is true? Because science and philosophy agree that the universe had a beginning. There was an origin to everything, that something came from nothing.
Nope, that is not what science agrees. Go watch the first part of this one if you want more in-depth coverage of that.
Because science is very, very clear that there is a level of appearance of fine-tuning in the universe that it makes it really, 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 really unlikely that it is the product of random chance alone.
Yeah, science also allows for the possibility that there are a potentially infinite number of attempts for the universe to get going. If there is such a small chance of it happening randomly, but you have an infinite number of iterations, you'll hit the small chance one eventually. There's also the fact that we are looking at this in a post hoc manner. Shuffle a deck of cards, and if you do it perfectly randomly, the resulting order of the cards has one chance in 8 times 10 to the 67th of occurring. That is so tiny as to be functionally impossible. In fact, often apologists will claim that anything smaller than 1 chance in 10 to the 50th is so improbable as to be functionally impossible.
The law of large numbers tells us that 1 followed by 50 zeros approaches mathematical impossibility.
And yet, every time a deck of cards is shuffled, it does come up with an order. And the odds that it would be the order that shows up are so small that creationists claim that it is impossible. What I'm getting at here is that even if I grant that it truly was completely random, the fact of the matter is that no matter which universe resulted from that combination of constants, it would have been just as unlikely as the one we are in now. An argument could be made that there are more combinations of constants that will result in no universe or a lifeless universe than those that will allow for life, and sure, that is a valid point, but the problem is that we just once again wind up back at the spot where we don't know how many iterations of failed universes happened before we got to ours, or if some version of the multiverse exists. Both scenarios essentially allow for arriving at workable universes through nothing but trial and error.
And again, I'm not saying that either of these arguments on their own 100% prove the existence of God or the God of the Bible, but what they do is they start providing evidence little by little that makes Christianity more likely and naturalism or atheism less likely.
Eh, they don't really do that, though. They only accomplish that if you ignore the fact that they rely entirely on assumptions about the origin of the universe that cannot be verified, and in fact some of which are thought to be definitely not true. So, if I assume that everything that you have said thus far is 100% true and accurate, which, to be clear, it absolutely was not, but if I assume that, then the best you can do is say that the existence of a supernatural creative force seems more likely than not. You can't even get to a specific creative force, just the general idea that it seems like maybe it's more likely that the universe was the result of a supernatural force. And we are going through the second part of this fast enough that I don't think I need to split it up, so we'll just finish off with argument number three now.
Now, argument number three is one of my favorites. Life from death.
Oh, this better be something more than just the we haven't nailed down all the specifics of abiogenesis yet, therefore God, or I am going to be very disappointed. That's right, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed. I thought you could be a better Switch pastor than that. Off topic, but I was informed on the last video that Switch can have multiple meanings, and the more common one is not the one that came up first on Urban Dictionary. It's usually meant to mean someone who switches between being a top and a bottom. Which was actually what I first thought it was, but then I figured that Urban Dictionary would know better than me, so I trusted them. But anyway, my advice still stands. Check Urban Dictionary before naming your religious organization, especially when that organization appears to be aimed at teenagers.
Because this is the argument that starts to make it more clear who this God is.
So, the third and final reason that you're giving for us to believe that Christianity is true is the one that just starts to make the case that the God whose existence you didn't even really establish in the other two is actually the Christian God? You can't even finish the job? Well, let's have it. What exactly is this argument, and how does it point specifically to the modern Christian interpretation of the God of the Bible? Which, let's be clear, is a very different God, even from the Christian interpretation of the God of the Bible from just a couple hundred years ago, let alone a couple thousand.
The Apostle Paul, who wrote the majority of the New Testament documents, wrote this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 14. He said that if Christ has not been raised, then all our preaching is useless and your faith is useless.
Congratulations! You found a verse in the Bible that I completely and fully agree with without having to caveat it at all. So, since Christ was not raised, y'all are going to stop preaching now, right?
You see, Christianity is the only falsifiable religion in the world.
Well, I don't know that it's the only one, but I would agree that it is falsifiable. Not only that, I would agree that it has been falsified. At least, I did so with a bunch of the more literal-minded denominations, because at the end of the day, it's not really falsifiable, because as long as you can confront obvious problems with the religion by just waving your hands and appealing to God's mysterious ways rather than even attempting to come up with a solution to the problem, then you bring it into the realm of the unfalsifiable.
We've got to know, did Jesus rise from the dead? Because if Jesus rose from the dead, then all of a sudden Christianity is true.
Sorry, buddy, but that's just not how it works. Even in your own worldview, there are people that raise from the dead that aren't also the Son of God sent to save humanity from their sins. Hell, there's even one guy that comes back from the dead just completely by accident because his dead body was tossed unceremoniously into Elisha's grave, and when his body touched Elisha's bones, he came back from the dead. So, maybe Jesus wasn't the Son of God, even if he did come back from the dead. Maybe his body was just tossed into a tomb that also contained one of Elisha's bones. Maybe it was Satan playing a trick. Maybe Jesus just got caught up in whatever resurrection caused the Jerusalem zombies from around the same time in Matthew. I presume you don't think any of the Jerusalem zombies were the literal human incarnation of God? Of course, none of this actually matters. My point is simply that even within your own worldview, it is possible that there is a reason for Jesus coming back from the dead that does not automatically make him the Son of a God who died for our sins. And if we leave the door open for competing supernatural ideas, then we're left with even more possibilities, like Maybe a god of mischief noticed that this Jesus guy built a bit of a cult following, and so raised him from the dead as a joke to see what would happen. Or a benevolent god who was a fan of his message and didn't want him to end his story by being executed like a criminal, gave him a second chance for a better ending. My god, there are as many potential explanations for Jesus' resurrection as there are religions. And that's even if we start with the assumption that it happened in the first place. Now, I'm sure this will come as a bit of a shock to a lot of you, but as it turns out, I don't actually agree that it happened in the first place. Shocking, I know. I'll give you a moment to recover.
Now, what's interesting is there are a lot of different atheists throughout the years who have understood this. And so they've gone on journeys to disprove the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah, what I find even more interesting is that, as with pretty much every other apologetic presentation regarding the resurrection, you can't seem to just get into what the evidence for the resurrection is. Instead, you go out of your way to poison the well against anyone who might not believe the resurrection claim. But at the end of the day, if you want me to believe something, the burden is on you to provide supporting evidence for that thing. It is not on me to disprove it. The most I owe you is a courtesy explanation as to why I find your argumentation to be insufficient to warrant a belief in the event. But even that isn't necessary. It's fine if someone doesn't know all the ins and outs and just is of the opinion that Jesus didn't come back from the dead for the same reason that they do not believe that Marduk defeated Tiamat in the cosmic creation battle. Ancient books make supernatural shit up all the time. We don't need to build a case against these other supernatural events. We just assume that they didn't happen or were an exaggeration of some kind until such a time as evidence comes forth to justify belief in the supernatural event. And the fact of the matter is that when we're talking about the study of human history, it is entirely a game of probabilities. We can never be 100% certain that we have all the details about any event from ancient history right, no matter how well attested they may be, and we figure out how the event likely unfolded by figuring out what way they were most likely to have unfolded based on the information that we have. And unfortunately for apologetics, a supernatural event having actually happened will always be less likely than just the author was mistaken, deceived, lying, or any number of other reasons why they might have just recorded an untrue event. Because it is an objectively true fact that sometimes people write down things that didn't actually happen. That will always be a more probable explanation than actual magic.
And what is so fascinating is the number of these people who set out to disprove Christianity and along the way ended up believing in the very thing they tried to prove false.
I swear, if he mentions J. Lee Warner Strobel Wallace, I might just punch myself in the dick.
Just a few of those names. J.D. Anderson, William Ramsey, Lee Strobel.
No! Why?
That, to my dear podcast listeners, was the sound of me punching myself in the dick, because I thought that would be a good idea for some reason.
And these were all people, like I said, who their original goal was to prove that Jesus didn't rise from the dead.
Yeah, we all know the cliched story of the hardcore atheist setting out to prove Christianity wrong, only to find themselves overwhelmed with all of the evidence in its favor. In my experience, these stories come across as manipulative. Now, it's not necessarily the case that the person telling the story is trying to manipulate people, but it does come across that way. Because I have essentially the opposite experience. I was a Christian, I wanted to stay a Christian, I called out to God asking him to reveal himself to me, like he promises that he will. And apologists will, I'm sure, claim that I wasn't sincere enough in my supplication. That's why I didn't get the revelation, because I wasn't a true Christian. But to me, in my own personal experience, that rings hollow because I know how sincere I was, and most atheists that I know had a similar experience when they were leaving Christianity. And all of this happened before I got into anything evidence-related. My search for evidence began when God didn't do a thing that he promised he would do, in an attempt to prove Christianity correct, and no matter how hard I looked, I couldn't find anything substantial. Also, side note, but I do find it interesting that when an atheist says that they truly, sincerely sought after God and were left empty-handed, the reason is that they weren't a true Christian. Clearly, they weren't sincere enough. But when that same atheist says that they don't believe in God, that same apologist will often turn around and then use Romans 1:20 to say that, of course they believe in not just God, but specifically the Christian God, because it says so right here in the Bible. Everybody believes in him. So we simultaneously are not sincere enough in our belief to get the revelation, and yet have already had him revealed to us because everybody gets enough revelation to essentially force them into belief. That seems slightly inconsistent, if you ask me.
There's a guy named Gary Habermas, who is one of the foremost experts on studying the resurrection of Jesus.
Are we really going to the minimal facts argument as your third and final argument, which is supposed to bring us from a nebulous God claim specifically to the God of Christianity? Okay, if you insist.
And along this journey, Gary Habermas and his team, they compiled a list of what he calls the minimal facts. And these are facts that more than 90% of those thousands of sources agree actually happened.
And the most remarkable thing about the minimal facts is that when you break the story down to those particular facts, what you're left with is that Jesus died, at least one of his followers had an experience that convinced them that Jesus came back from the dead, that those who were convinced of his resurrection were willing to die because of it, that the resurrection was taught fairly soon after the crucifixion, and that two other dudes who came later also had experiences that convinced them. Now, setting aside the dubious nature of some of these quote-unquote facts, like the willingness to die for a lie one, which has its basis in documents that are considered entirely unreliable, except for the specifics of the deaths of some of the disciples, so that stinks of post hoc cherry picking, but even if we grant all this, it does not lead to the conclusion that Jesus actually came back from the dead. It leads us to the conclusion that at least three people had an experience that convinced them that he did, and that they shared these experiences with others, some of whom believe them. An actual resurrection need not be employed in order to explain that.
And so what Gary Habermas presents are these minimal facts, and he just asks the question, based off of these facts that more than 90% of these thousands of sources agree took place, what is the best explanation?
Guy died, one of his friends had a bereavement hallucination that he interpreted as being his buddy being back from the dead, he spreads word of this event, people believed him because Jesus said that he would come back from the dead, people were encouraged to have experiences with the risen Christ for themselves, and since we know from studying neurology and group effects on the brain that this will make them more susceptible to having such experiences, a number of them do, so word spreads of Jesus having risen from the dead. Later, James and Paul have similar experiences for themselves, and so also become Christians. If push comes to shove and you insist on including the they wouldn't die for a lie line in this version of events, even though that is a really bad argument all by itself, then they are convinced that the experiences that they had are real, and so they do not need to die for a lie. They just need to be willing to die for what they think is the truth. This does not seem outside the realm of possibility. In fact, it doesn't even seem to be outside the realm of plausibility.
So what I want to do is I want to present to you these facts. We're just going to go in order, these minimal facts. There's anywhere from 6 to 12. I'm just going to give you 6 of them because I don't have time to give you all 12. So,
and hear me out on this, you're going with 6 because that's what the original list of 12 got whittled down to over the years as more and more scholars came to disagree with items on the list, and so we're left with a rather pathetic-looking list of 6 facts that are incredibly easy to explain without the necessity of an actual resurrected Jesus. Now, unless he uses different facts from an older list, I'm just going to skip ahead here, as we have already covered this.
What is the best explanation for these facts?
Well, I already gave you what I consider to be quite a plausible explanation, but at the end of the day, we come back to the fact that it really doesn't matter. You're trying to prove a supernatural event using historical methods. That's just not possible because of how historical methods work. If we never find any plausible naturalistic explanation for how these 6 facts came to be, it will still be a true statement that the idea that the authors who wrote the books that include the stories of Jesus' resurrection were just wrong or lying is more likely than an actual resurrection. But I mean, we already do have a plausible naturalistic explanation. Several of them, in fact. I just gave you the one that resonates with me. And even then, they go farther than they need to, because at least one of the 6 minimal facts is very dubious. I don't think it's even necessary to account for how the disciples would have died, as all the disciples disappear from reliable history immediately after the crucifixion. And even that is granting the Gospels as reliable history, which is another huge and unnecessary concession.
I believe that the best explanation is that Jesus did exactly what he said he was going to do. that he rose from the dead.
Well, bully for you. I remain unconvinced.
Now, the difficult thing here, though, is that if you already assume that God is fake and that miracles are impossible, then of course you will come up with any other explanation than God performed a miracle and brought Jesus back from the dead, right? Like, if you already assume there is no God.
Whether I believe that a miracle is possible or not is completely irrelevant. The fact remains that, by its very nature, a miracle will always be a much less likely explanation than even the wildest of naturalistic explanations. The idea that a super advanced species of aliens felt bad for Jesus having died and so used their advanced medical technology to revive him is more likely than an actual miracle, because as wildly unlikely and implausible as it is, it does not require the suspension of the laws of physics in order for it to happen. The fact that miracles are a scientific impossibility is what makes them miracles, but it also keeps them firmly outside of the realm of verification, especially historical verification, when it will always be more likely that the author was just wrong about something than that actual magic happened.
When science and scripture agree that the universe is just right for the existence of life, all of a sudden, it opens the door to the possibility that maybe, just maybe, there is more to the world than what we see around us.
Maybe. But the fact of the matter is that you have to ignore what scientists actually say in order to get to the conclusion that science and the Bible are in agreement. So to me, this seems to make it much less likely that this is the case.
Because if you can create the universe in a moment, you better believe raising somebody from the dead, like that's easy.
You know, I know apologists like to say this, but it just doesn't follow. One skill set does not necessarily require that the other skill set is also present. Just because I can build the Saturn V Lego kit does not mean that if one of the Lego bricks gets snapped in two, that I am then capable and have the skills required to put it back together in such a way as to make it as good as new.
But the reality is that me presenting these arguments and this evidence to you may or may not convince you.
Yeah, I'm leaning toward not. That's it for this one. From here on out, he just summarizes and then goes into proselytization mode. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Fearless Nimue. Sorry for saying that wrong, probably. Who says, why should any deity care about humanity's sex lives? Well, ostensibly, as far as the Christian God is concerned, it's because he cares about us and wants what is best for us, and so he laid out some rules that would better enable us to have happy and healthy sex lives. But since pretty much all the research on the topic shows that the rules about sex that Christians favor are objectively harmful, that means that this cannot be why God cares about our sex lives, so maybe God's got a fetish? He just likes seeing humans struggle to control the urges that he gave them, so he outlaws a bunch of the not only harmless but often beneficial stuff in order to get his own rocks off? I don't know, that's about all I can come up with. Thanks for watching. Thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager. Speaking of, I know I have a few new patrons, but there were some technical difficulties with Tim updating the spreadsheet this week, so I'll make sure to get y'all next week. Thanks to this week's PayPal hero, Martin, and special thanks to all my patrons, who are the mention of J. Warner Wallace or Lee Strobel that results in the punch that is my channel. If you'd like to make extra sure that my vasectomy was effective, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time! It was when Matthew Fontaine Maury, why can't I say that?